Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk lumber liquidators, but we'll also talk bankruptcy. Seems like a while since we've talked about a bankruptcy in the retail space. We'll close out the news section of our show with two grocery stores in the news this last week, and Leighton in particular has a looking ahead regarding Warren Buffett. First, remember to like us, rate us wherever you listen to us, whether it be on iTunes, Podbean, or someplace else, including Spotify. You can also check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast and on Instagram at Retail Podcast there as well. So we begin today's show with Lumber Liquidators, a retailer Leighton loves to cover. They reported second quarter earnings that missed estimates on Tuesday, and the stock was cut by over 15% this week as a result. It seems like Lumber Liquidators, more than any other company we talk about on this podcast, has seen its share of ups and downs over the last 3 years, more downs probably than ups. It's a company we've kept a close eye on since the inception of this podcast simply because of that roller coaster ride. The company, whether it's settling government claims and civil claims for the formaldehyde-related controversy from that 60-minute special, or the bounce back, it seems like this company is always relevant. And up until this earnings call, they seem to have righted the ship. They've had several quarters of profitability, but things are still extremely inconsistent, and the growth they've had in their top line has not really been blowing off the doors of analysts or shareholders.
Full transparency, I am what you would call a long-term shareholder within Lumber Liquidators. I got in a few months after the formaldehyde debacle, after I thought it hit rock bottom. That was not rock bottom. The shares ended up going closer to $10 a share, which makes the stock actually look pretty good right now because they're hovering around $20 a share. But this is, to Trent's point, a company that has seen ups and downs. And if you're a longtime shareholder like myself, you are probably frustrated with management and how things have been going. However, the positive here, and something we will be diving into with this particular second quarter earnings call, is the fact that they have made some important executive transformation. And this progress seems to be a little bit slow, but I think the company has the right strategy in place for the long term. However, you still have to be patient if you are a shareholder. It's not going to take off and explode anytime soon. And in my opinion, as long as they are headed towards profitability, this is a company to keep your eye on. This quarter was really more or less than what we've seen in the past year. Over the past year, Lumber Liquidators has actually exceeded estimates for earnings per share half the time while missing the other half. So that right there tells you about the inconsistency from within the company. GAAP earnings per share this quarter hit negative territory at negative 5 cents per share. Wall Street had expected the company to be profitable, which they were on a non-GAAP basis. A lot of one-time costs for the company, a lot of lawyering, a lot of expenses still around federal settlements. Net loss of $1.45 million versus 2017's stellar $4.4 million. This was when the stock was headed back up. Revenue was 7.6% higher. However, the $283 million for the second quarter that brought in was actually beating estimates, but most of that revenue growth was actually in line for the full year expectations that the company had. What is most notable here for the full year expectations is that they missed analyst full year estimate despite beating this top line number here in the most recent quarter. No matter the figure, it should still be within a $1 billion realm for the company to hit the top line revenue marks this year. Same store sales were up 4.7%, 4.6% increase in average ticket, a 0.1% increase in transactions. So the positive here is that both numbers are up, volume and people are coming in and shopping their stores. This solid comp and 8 new stores contributed to the better than expected top line revenue increase. 13 new stores year to date. They are actually aiming for around 20 to 25 for the full year.
Let's get into some of the details that were covered on this earnings call. The call focused more on the future than a larger explanation of what went wrong during the second quarter. And as Leighton talked about, there are some good numbers here from the second quarter, but again, missing analyst expectations. Customer care for the company has been a focus. They feel like it's paying off in the form of solid feedback and those solid comps. Remember, Leighton said those solid comps were driven by an increase in average ticket. A lot of that, they feel like, is stemming from that customer care, some of the upsells from the staff. The increased customer attention has come at a cost, though, SG&A being arguably a little bit too high for this type of business. They'll be looking actually to cut this expense in future quarters as a percentage of sales. Particularly, they want that back in line by the end of their fiscal year, so over the next couple of quarters. We warned the company, of course, you don't want to hurt momentum that increased staffing has built up, particularly with average ticket size. And we do have to remember that most legal costs are accounted for as well in SG&A. Legal costs have dogged this company now for a couple of years. So this quarter, those costs were $6 million. Last year, they were $3.5 million, going in the wrong direction for some. We thought the end was at least close in terms of some of the lawsuits and the money going out the door from the lawsuits, but also the legal fees. That's not clear that that's happening, but we hope that the end would be near for the company, at least over the next few quarters, as they try to get that into the past and put that behind them. So that's still dogging the SG&A number a little bit. But gross margin also was down to 35.7% of sales, the gross margin. They blamed transportation costs, inventory clearancing, and promotional pricing. And I found this interesting, particularly with that increase in average ticket. We talk about the increased customer attention that the staff is giving and the potential for upsells in that environment. But one thing that is clearly the case here with these inventory clearances and with these promotional prices is that not only are people buying more in terms of dollar amount, but they're buying much more in terms of material, buying up some of these clearanced items. And I feel like this climate of clearancing for Lumber Liquidators is actually a product of what we've seen in terms of inventory levels over the last couple of years. Just like we talk about the roller coaster in terms of quarterly results, so too have their inventory levels been on a bit of a roller coaster. Now they find themselves at a very high inventory level as they were trying to diversify their inventory for their customer base, and that hasn't worked out, at least for gross margins benefit. But good news, the pro business has been a larger portion of sales. This is something Lumber Liquidators has poured a lot of resources into over the last 3 to 4 quarters, and now the pro business up to 25% of total sales.
Just like with the contractor business, or what they call the pro business, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the nationwide rollout of their installation business, which is now fully complete. And as a result, they hit a record number for installation segment revenues, higher ticket volume here. Obviously, this is exactly what Trent just said, and that you have customers coming in thinking they're going to just be buying flooring, but they end up buying a whole installation package, which in turn increases average ticket. And yes, to answer your question, installation packages do get included in the per ticket revenue. Total installation sales were up 51% for Lumber Liquidators. So this is definitely a bright spot for the company. Continued differentiation involves pulling the same levers here as for everyone else. So Lumber Liquidators, just like Home Depot and Lowe's, just like they talk about on every earnings call there, they talked about during the second quarter selection, promoting value through sales, like Trent had just mentioned, and the aforementioned service, whether that's the pro business or the installation side of the business. The key here is the marketing differences, and they feel like this is now for them going smoothly. Really, the first time in quite some time, they feel like they've had efficient marketing campaigns, but also more time spent and more money spent on advertising thanks to some seasonal pushes. However, all of those expenditures, again, they feel is extremely efficient and it's working for the right customer base. Inventory-wise, just like Trent had alluded to, again, they claim to be carrying the right items, even though they're carrying more inventory. They think they're identifying the right trends for their product selection. They have a new waterproof vinyl flooring, a white hardwood as well that has been selling very well. They're hyper-focused on trending products or themes, textures, colors, designs, whatever it means for their product. They hope to have it. We talked about some falling gross margins. They are adamant about the marginability with these newer products, particularly the newer vinyl products, where they can really boost in some margin there because they're taking advantage of customer demand. They feel like customers are really loving the product and will pay anything for it. Interestingly enough, vinyl is replacing some of their bamboo sales, which, as we remember from this podcast a couple years ago, that was the hot topic for flooring centers around the United States. Everyone was talking about their new bamboo selection. They are exiting, we should mention, their finishing material space as they got in 1.5 to 2 years ago, originally intended to be a move for vertical integration, but they weren't seeing their business as the one being the low-cost option for finished materials.
Now let's talk about those executive changes Leighton referenced in the beginning. An executive will be taking the helm as the chief ethics and compliance officer. Obviously, ethics and compliance, a big deal for Lumber Liquidators since those slew of lawsuits, not only with government compliance here, but also the quality and analysis of sourcing will be the focal points for this position. They're also appointing a new chief customer experience officer, Charles Tyson. He comes by way of Advanced Auto Parts and Office Max. These two additions, at least the company says, will mark the end of their transformation period at the executive level that came after the lawsuits. They shined a light on why they were moving their headquarters as well. They're moving their headquarters off to Richmond, Virginia. They feel as though a smaller, more efficient corporate space was not only desired, but also more cost effective. Also, their lease on their current corporate headquarters was up this year. By moving it to Richmond, they feel like they're going to get a deeper talent pool there. It is a larger metropolitan area. They already have a distribution center already in Richmond. And Richmond, Virginia, for those who don't know, it is a developing metropolis in terms of the talent pool that's there. You're seeing a lot of tech companies move to the Richmond, Virginia area as well. There's going to be a small financial impact in the positive direction from this, but they feel like the culture change, more than the money saved, will be far more important for future growth, especially having staff to pull from in that area. Now, shares have been all over the place this year. They're now down about 21% since January, including this last week's sell-off. Leighton is still a shareholder, as he mentioned at the beginning of the story. He may sell sooner rather than later, as there's no real growth to be had for the next couple of years, despite being in a very strong sector. We've seen them kind of top out. Shares below $20 were over 24 prior to earnings, but 24 really kind of where they were topping out even prior to this negative news, just under a $600 million market cap heading into next week.
The electronics having mall occupying staple where we have all gotten at one time or another a free chair massage is going bankrupt after rumors and more rumors over the last few weeks. Brookstone has made it official that they are filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The Brookstone company had previously filed in 2014 and sold to Sandpower Group, a China-based conglomerate. Brookstone was saved, but the sales reportedly have not been saved. They've been going downward ever since that 2014 acquisition. If we look at a quick history of Brookstone, a company that we have not talked on this podcast a lot about, we find this a relevant retail news story because of its impact on malls, because you've been seeing mall stories, mall closures all around the country for some time now, and the local economies where it's going to affect the workers, it's going to affect retail rents, but also because of the unique retail customer and consumer that they serve. Brookstone was a concept born in Peterborough, New Hampshire in 1973. In fact, they opened their first location. So the concept has been around for some time. It's more or less a fun zone for both kids and adults where they're able to try out most electronic gadgets and toys prior to purchasing them. Drones, helicopters, tablet accessories, massage chairs, anti-gravity devices, among other items that they have featured in the store. Again, just like with the massage chairs, you can end up flying a drone or a helicopter around the store and potentially hitting another customer. You have to be careful for that sort of thing. But that is what they were known for. They were known for their displays out in the mall setting, out in front of traffic to catch people's attention. That will be no more. This is to say that their selection has evolved over time. This is something they have done well, trying to take advantage of new fads and the latest gift ideas around the holiday season. They've actually been known more recently, too, as having more lifestyle items. So we mentioned massage chairs, but they also have different types of pillows and that sort of thing to help improve one's life. One would think that the wireless tech and drones alone would have kept Brookstone afloat, but people are beginning to be more comfortable buying three-figure and in some cases four-figure items, sight unseen sometimes, online by looking at just reviews or by simply going to the stores like Brookstone, trying them out, looking at the specs, and then buying them online hours later for potentially less of a price.
Leighton mentioned hitting another customer in a Brookstone store with a drone. I wonder if he's got some personal experience with that. But Leighton talked about the history, too. In 1973, they opened their first location. You fast forward to the mid-90s. The company was actually taken public by Bain Capital, who at the time, the leader was Mitt Romney. In 2005, the company was then taken private again by several different parties. Since the inception, the business has found its home in many malls across America, but also airports and some well-known tourist destinations. At one point, there were as many as 310 Brookstones in the United States. They did lose 70 stores between 2006 and 2014, sandwiched in that date range, of course, the Great Recession, but it appears as though the problems for Brookstone were a little bit deeper. As of this Thursday, when the motions were filed, Brookstone operated just 137 stores, 35 of these in airports, and some of those airport locations might actually be spared or sold off in the bankruptcy proceedings, as Leighton will talk about here in a second. Brookstone once had a thriving catalog business as well. Of course, with most catalog businesses, it diminished with time and increased spending on the internet. In 2006 alone, they printed more than 55 million catalogs. That, too, going by the wayside. The 2014 purchase by SandPower was for over $173 million. And then you fast forward to now, just 4 years after that purchase, it appears as though the retailer will at least be closing all of their mall locations. Their CFO said shopping mall traffic declining was a major reason for their financial woes. But as Leighton mentioned, even in A and B class malls where the population is up, they just aren't attracting the customer base or the expenditures that people are used to making or people were used to making over a decade ago. And I think you see the long-term financial struggles of a company like Brookstone. It's very easy to blame it on mall woes. But again, a lot of malls they were in were these Class A shopping centers. Those are malls that haven't really seen the traffic declines like the B and C shopping centers. Actually, their CFO went on to say during these proceedings that they've been operating mall stores at a loss since the bankruptcy debacle of 2014 when they were purchased by SandPower. So they were never able to recover. And even though a lot of people attribute the mall loss in terms of customer base, over the last 2 to 3 years, we see here that they really haven't been profitable for quite some time.
I would actually love to dig a little further into the numbers, because to say they have been operating at a loss for all of their mall stores really makes me scratch my head, because to Trent's point, some of the locations they are in are extremely busy. You can't actually blame mall traffic for a number of their Class A malls for which they inhabit. So I'm curious to see if they just mean portfolio-wise, it's actually been operating in a declining way, or if they're saying that literally every individual store inside a mall has been operating at a loss. That would be very troublesome if I were leadership and that were happening. But airport locations are said to be profitable because of positive foot traffic. Airports obviously have been doing quite well. A lot more people are flying. And because of that, you're going to see more foot traffic, more people interested into what those Brookstone locations have. Beyond traffic levels, the company's management has been in flux at the senior levels. So a lot of people, a lot of analysts, a lot of employees actually have been pointing to senior executive management as the reason for their slow adoption on being better than average in their online marketplace and product selection. And if you look, the CEO actually admitted here recently that they hadn't had their eyes on the ball, or at least didn't right away in the digital sense. It becomes very obvious when you go to brookstone.com, their e-commerce website, right now, where Trent and I actually just spent some good quality time there, where they're advertising back to school items right now. Their e-commerce business does not allow for much in the way of free shipping, unless, of course, you spend $75 or more, like a lot of other websites have. However, the differentiator here is even then, there are multiple exclusions for many of the items they carry. So you could actually come away with a shopping cart of over $75 and still have to pay certain shipping costs. So that's a no-go in today's e-commerce realm. The categories are also scrunched together up at the top, a little bit confusing, and they have different optionality that doesn't even make too much sense. I'll give you an example. They've actually separated some items by gender, so you can actually shop as a male or a female, even though a lot of the products, if you click through to the subcategories that they have, let's say wine sets, massage chairs, slippers, and fitness equipment, is pretty much standardized in unisex. There's no reason to split that type of thing up. I'm very curious as to who made that decision up at the top any modern website or e-commerce website that sells their type of product does not usually separate like that, at least from the very beginning, at the front of their website. Upon clicking a subcategory, you can actually only sort by price, another downside for them. There are extremely little reviews to go by if you click on some items. Some don't have a review at all. You're sort of buying in the dark, if you will. And most items only have one or two pictures, not really letting you see the angle for the more ornamental products, where it becomes a little bit more important if you are a consumer that you're trying to compare versus them and their competitors. You want to be able to see how big an item is in relation to you or maybe some other adjacent items that you're buying.
Another negative for the company has apparently been how the company has handled the news for its workers. According to NPR, many Brookstone employees only found out about the recent news on social media. This even after the public statements from leadership, a sign, surely, of a company that's not operating on all cylinders whatsoever. It looks as though the remaining assets of the business that don't get liquidated, including those better-off airport locations, are set to be sold by the end of September, or at least that's what the company is hoping. They're targeting the end of September to have everything finalized. Now, in the meantime, they've secured a $30 million loan to continue business through those liquidation sales, as they still have some rent payments and personnel to pay. As we've talked about in the past, a lot of commercial leases are airtight, but when you throw in a bankruptcy, all of that goes out the window. So they've still got to spend some time navigating those rent payments in the interim and until everything is filed away and set in stone. And although we don't have exact figures, liabilities were listed as being up to $500 million, and get this, assets only between $50 to $100 million. That's what happens when you operate stores at a loss for four consecutive years. Analysts have seen mall vacancies at six-year highs, but as we've talked about, this is mostly brought on from the B and C class malls. Brookstone has a presence in every class of mall, making their rent rates vary widely, which is one of those reasons why Layton said he'd like to see the numbers kind of broken down location by location, although it's likely we will never know which stores were doing well and which stores were failing. The main question, though, going forward is who, if anyone, is going to be interested in Brookstone's remaining operations, including those airport stores. Some analysts say that Brookstone's presence is actually one that fills a desired niche, and that it's not as easy to say that potential Brookstone sales would be going directly into any one existing business, including Amazon. But I think one thing is for certain, whoever buys Brookstone's existing business, obviously the airport locations are something certainly that people would look towards acquiring, but the e-commerce presence has got to be bulked up for all of those reasons that Layton mentioned. Well, coming up after the music, we're switching gears and we're going into grocery for our last two stories. And one natural grocer in particular had a solid quarter that saw their share price raise in the double digits.
Trent is talking about Sprouts, who had a solid quarter showing that they can compete with the best grocery powerhouses that currently exist in the United States. The grocery landscape is more or less an oligopoly of sorts now, with Kroger, Albertsons, and Walmart still at the top as they have been for the last several years. Target, Aldi, Trader Joe's, and Whole Foods have measurable impacts as well as Publix, which we'll talk about a little later. Regardless, the size of Sprouts' competitors makes it all the more impressive that they actually have been able to grow in the recent past, given the relative buying power of Kroger and Walmart. You talk about those famous price wars and case studies where Kroger and Walmart have that leverage over suppliers to beat out their competition. They celebrated their 16th anniversary as they crossed the 300 store mark this year during the most recent quarter, in fact. And speaking of growth, they have repeatedly entered new and existing territories not far away from other major grocery anchors. Trent and I were talking most recently about an example where they've actually been opening stores very close to both Walmart and Kroger locations. So these are brand new locations, expensive locations, money that they've been funneling in for these new projects, and they are not intimidated in the least to open right next door to these powerhouses. For the latest quarter, their second quarter, they showcased a double-digit gain in revenue, a 12% rise to be exact, with sales coming in at $1.32 billion. So far for the 2018 calendar year, this is actually a 13% increase for the last two quarters if you combine the two quarters. Same-store sales yet again rose a positive 2%. This figure was right in the middle of their anticipated full-year mark, which is between 1.5 and 2.5%. Again, for full-year same-store sales. And lastly, for my bit here, we talk about net income as that hit $41.7 million, just $700,000 greater than last year's profits. Doesn't seem too impressive, but again, they're up against crazy competition. And as we'll talk about, a lot of capital expenditures, a lot of improvement in terms of wages that they've been funneling in profits for, and technology, leading to a 3.15 net margin, which is not horrible if you're an up-and-coming grocer, as Sprouts is.
Yeah, that 3.15% net margin would be impressive enough if they were just a regional grocer, but it's more impressive for Sprouts when you talk about the fact, as Leighton did, that they had more of what they call these direct store expenses and more CapEx. Wages, healthcare benefits, also more expensive. Now, they had planned for this, but luckily for them, tax breaks from Congress that we've been hearing retailers discuss over the last 6 months helped to ease the pain from this additional overhead cost. Their selling, general, and administrative expenses were up slightly as a percentage of sales to 3.3% versus 3.2% in 2017, as you can figure from that highly low number. They file some things a little bit differently than most retailers do on the financial end. Their earnings per share was positively affected by some 8.3 million shares being bought back during the course of the last year, and gross margins did decrease a modest 10 basis points to 28.8% of sales. Again, we can chalk this up to reduced prices as a result of trying to remain competitive with the larger competitors, as their promotions did erode average selling prices throughout this last quarter. Now, their revenue increase was not only attributable to same-store sales heading upward, but also having a larger store base. Leighton talked about the fact that they're up over 300 stores now. There are 7 new Sprouts from the second quarter alone, and 4 have already opened for their fiscal third quarter, and we're barely a month into their fiscal third quarter. 305 stores altogether, with a new state in their store portfolio in South Carolina. Again, unafraid of competition here, including Lidl, which has several locations in the Carolinas. And one thing we should mention is the way Sprouts expands, they'll expand market by market rather than just putting one store in one market, one store in another market. So when they expand to a new state, it is notable because you can expect expansions coming in behind that as they build out their distribution network. It's very unique how Sprouts has been growing, but it's worked for them. And that 305 stores, that's no small feat. A quick comparison of store count shows that they are not far off from their direct competition. Whole Foods has 479 locations, Trader Joe's a little bit over 475, and Natural Grocers still bringing up the rear around 140, although you could make the argument that they're expanding the quickest among all of those four businesses between Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, Sprouts, and of course Natural Grocers. But just like with Lumber Liquidators, Sprouts took time to mention a new executive appointment. Dave McGlinchey is taking over as chief marketing officer. He had been with Shaw's and Star Market as well as Giant Food. So moving from one food company to another in his new role as CMO.
From their rather clear and colorful investor relations page that we love because it's so transparent, we see that the company is most proud of their sales increase and their two-year same-store sales stack of 3.4%. So if you look at the same-store sales for the last year and a half to 2 years, they've actually been above average in terms of how their immediate competition is faring. We look at companies like Natural Grocers and the like to make those comparisons, but investments in their people, as we can see from the wages and benefit packages going up, along with technological capital expenditures, help to fuel interest in their brand. They feel like having all of that is going to help them in terms of customer service, which is going to make people associate positive things with their brand. They see these investments as yielding both short-term and long-term positive results. So this makes sense because anytime you talk about brand, you talk about a long-term investment. You talk about brand equity, money that you have previously spent compounded with the money you currently are spending to really have your consumer gauge their overall interest in your business. They have been known to be very data heavy in their business model, and this shows with their promotional merchandising strategy as of late, extremely strategic with seasonal goods and trending food items and snacks. You can go into their stores, and if it's a particular type of the month where something is really hot or trending, a produce item, you better believe that's going to be on the end cap or a featured item when you come into the store. They see themselves being a leader in innovation and health. Health being a word that is oddly not commonly used among stores that are focused on organic or natural offerings. Natural Grocers, to their credit, is all about good-for-you marketing campaigns. They use a variety of research techniques Sprouts does to keep a close eye on health trends and where customers want their food to be sourced and what labels appeal to the customers to their ever-evolving tastes. And I think this is extremely important. If you're Sprouts, it is very important to identify what works and what doesn't, whether or not it's private label or it's from a producer that is well known. They didn't speak too specifically on category leaders and what trends they have identified as surging, but that is probably for the best as to keep those secrets to themselves. They did say that the meals on the go were appealing and that anything that gets the consumer to feel like there's a high level of service is important. This spans their product offering and, like I said, their associates working the sales floor. Anytime they're a little bit happier, the customer can also end up a little bit happier.
Sprouts is a company that we've been bullish on for quite some time, and the company continues to deliver. In our view, they've done a good job of acknowledging its niche, identifying what their core competencies are, not growing too much too soon. We especially like their expansion plans where they keep stores fairly close to distribution centers. This helps to explain also the different capital allocation between share buybacks, CapEx, wages, new stores, and a relatively tight supply chain. And they try to sprinkle a little bit of growth throughout their own company in addition to how they're expanding with those new stores. Sprouts is a company we feel like has a bright future, not possibly the best valuation right now for an acquisition target if you were looking at such a thing, but we wouldn't be surprised to see them bought up in the next couple of years. It's been rumored a lot. Worst case scenario for them is that they keep slowly growing their presence and their brand to at least be on par with the smaller group of U.S. grocers, namely someone like Trader Joe's with their 475 locations. I think that's worst case scenario. Best case scenario, the trend breaks out a little bit larger. It's hard to see them grow to the size of a regional grocer like Publix, who we'll talk about in the next story, has just under 1,200 locations. They're still on track to add a total of 30 stores in 2018, including those 7 that they added in quarter 2 and the 3 that they've added so far in this quarter. And Layton, shares ticker SFM, rose 12.4% on their report Thursday.
Something to mention previously, Trent had mentioned SG&A being 3.3% of revenue. That is an especially low number because they actually break out direct store expenses. So you see labor actually factored into that. So if you look on their earnings release, that is why SG&A is so very low. I thought I should point that out because a lot of people are probably scratching their heads saying that they only spend 3-4% in selling, general, administrative expenses. That is actually a misnomer. They break everything down on their website. The big rise in their stock price, as Trent mentioned, ticker SFM, was likely due to them raising the low end of their earnings per share full year guidance. Obviously, not meeting their quarterly expectations was the reason of the stock going upwards like this. So anytime you see a stock movement, a lot of that has to do with their future projections. Everything else, including CapEx and same-store sales, remained the same for their full-year projections. Shares finished on Thursday around $23.83 a share. 52-week highs for the company around $28. Lows around $17. So a lot of volatility in between for the 52 weeks. Current price to earnings ratio is 19 to 20 times, which is not horrible considering the multiples that other companies are trading at in this environment. They currently have a market cap of $3.1 billion. And to put this in perspective, lastly, Kroger is a company with nearly 12 times the net income of Sprouts, has a market cap of only 7.7 times that of Sprouts, leaving its trading multiple around 10 times trailing earnings. So either one company is an extreme value or one company is extremely overpriced. It's just funny to point out that two companies in the same market have two totally different valuations.
Well, from one grocery store to another, Publix released information regarding their second quarter, and while not publicly traded, Publix does offer stock to employees, meaning they do release a limited amount of financial information to the media and their employees. Publix is one of, if not the largest grocery retail chain in the United States, 1,190 locations all told. But those locations are condensed into 7 states, and 787 of those stores are in Florida, where Publix is the market share leader there, particularly after Southeastern Grocers' recent struggles. Analysts in the past have actually called Publix's Florida market share and I quote, unrealistic. I'm not sure that we're in the same boat as that, but it is a product of significant brand loyalty over the last several decades that Publix has been able to cultivate. I don't know that it's unrealistic if they can continue to cultivate that brand loyalty. As a company, Publix had $34.6 billion in retail sales in fiscal 2017. So to put their company in perspective, in terms of location base, Albertsons Safeway has about 2,300 stores. Kroger is just shy of 2,800. So Publix is about half the size in terms of stores, but their per store revenue does come in higher than Albertsons. This despite their heavy regional focus in the southeastern United States. Now let's get to those numbers. Sales, as they happen to call revenue, came in at $8.8 billion for the quarter, an increase of $400 million from a year ago. This increase was partially the product of same-store sales, which were up 1.7%, but also partially the product of unit expansion, with new stores in the northern portion of their region helping boost the 4% top-line increase. A 1.7% same-store sales increase is roughly in line with the national rate of inflation this year, expected to be around 1.9% in 2018 over 2017. However, if you break it down and look at only food and food inflation was 1.4% in June of 2018, which was the last month in this quarter, and that's year over year. So Publix, just like Walmart's neighborhood market, and Kroger as well, is outpacing food inflation. We find food inflation a better comparison proxy for grocery chains versus overall inflation, which carries with it a number of other extraneous numbers that perhaps aren't important for grocery chains, even chains like Publix that have a pharmacy and other aspects to their stores that go above and beyond food.
Perhaps the number that most impressed us was their bottom line, as net earnings grew to $616.2 million. This was up from $495 million, an increase of an astounding 24.5%. This amounts to a net margin of 7%, which, if you remember just a second ago, we talked about the 3.1% net margins from Sprouts. This 7% is unheard of in the grocery business, or at least the mature grocery business. It certainly seems as though they are beginning to reap the rewards from significant capital expenditures to build out their distribution network. Supply chain is ultra important here. Also, to credit their federal tax rate decrease from 35 to around 21% and a new accounting standard. These accounted for around $45.2 million in additional earnings. However, these had smaller impacts than did operational efficiencies, which really speaks to the amount that they've been focusing on supply chain, because if you wipe out taxes and accounting standards all away, their net earnings would still have reflected a 15.3% increase year over year. They are an example of a company that is hitting on all cylinders. All of this good financial news coming despite the fact that Easter was shifted to the first quarter of this fiscal year. Many, including us, saw Publix absorbing a slightly negative impact. They did not, however, and we ended up being incorrect, as we so often are on this podcast. The company also increased their share price from around $41.75 a share to $42.55 per share. Since the company is not publicly traded, they effectively have a bit more control over share price and how everything works with their immediate shareholders. While shares are still off of all-time highs, they have increased from $36.85 a share to $42.55 since the beginning of the year. Not bad for Publix. This echoes the increase we've seen with the likes of Kroger, up from around $23 a share from earlier this year to around $30 a share as of recording this podcast this week. It would be safe to say that grocery bears are beginning to recede.
Let's talk about some other Publix adjacent news, as the earnings came amidst other news stories surrounding the regional grocer. For example, Kroger has shown signs of desiring to challenge Publix in the crowded Florida market, but not in the way you might think. Kroger currently has just one large format store location, which is a Harris Teeter in northern Florida. Kroger, however, did purchase a 74,000 square foot shopping center in Delray Beach, which is in Palm Beach County, for $15 million, according to the Sarasota Herald Tribune this week. News of the purchase broke Wednesday, although that particular article notes that it was unclear at the time Kroger's plans for the property. However, we were guessing that they weren't just building out their real estate portfolio, and this time we were actually right. Indeed, just a few hours later, it turned out that Kroger was not using the location for a Kroger-branded store, but for a Lucky's Market, which is a Colorado-based Kroger-backed chain with 13 existing Florida locations. So indeed, Kroger is using it through their own devices. This much was clarified by Tampa Bay Business Journal reporter Ashley Gerball-Kreitzer this week. In particular, this Lucky's location will be 29,000 square feet, leaving Kroger with plenty of other space in the shopping center to deal with. Much smaller than the typical Kroger, that 29,000 square feet, but in line with the other Lucky's Market locations. Lucky's Market, by the way, the type of grocery store that's seeing an increase in popularity in Florida and particularly the Tampa area. I'm not sure if they're analogous to Sprouts in terms of actual selection. I think they're a little bit closer to a Whole Foods. I think they have a larger organic selection than Sprouts does and generally more of a natural selection than Whole Foods does. But in any case, these type of grocery stores have been very popular and particularly popular in the Tampa area. An April article in the Tampa Bay Times cited growth in the natural food space with new locations for Earth Fair, Sprouts, and Lucky's in 2017 and 2018. There's a contractor actually in the area, Dale Scott, and he was quoted as saying that he had four natural food chains battling for a single spot as an anchor in a project he was working on. This, of course, good for contractors like Dale, property owners, and it's also good for real estate investors. Anytime you get competition for a spot, it means lease terms are going to be more favorable for the owners, and also those lease rates are going to be higher in the end. But why are we talking about this single location in Tampa? Well, to bring it full circle, in response to this phenomenon of these stores, these smaller square footage natural food stores being so popular in Florida, Publix has plans in the works for their own small format natural foods market. It's actually named Greenwise Market, which is named after their private label organic brand, and they're looking to have similar square footage in their stores. Three locations are planned, two in Florida, one in South Carolina. Now, their website, which is introductory at this point, gives the future locations, boasts that Greenwise Market will have kombucha on tap along with acai bowls and things like craft beer for consumption on premises. And I quote, "Our carts have cup holders on the site." So they're really trying to drive home that grocerant ideal, the almost bar in a store or hangout in a store ideal. Their grocerant will feature pizza, sandwiches, and bowls that they have pictures of on the website that look a lot like something coming from a Chipotle or a Qdoba. Now, this is not Publix's first spin-off attempt, this natural food store called Greenwise Market. They have seven Publix Sabora stores that cater to the Hispanic population in Florida as well. So Greenwise Market, a new trip for Publix, and we'll see how that affects not only earnings in the future, but whether or not after running these three locations out there, they decide to expand, because this is a market in Florida as a whole, the entire state, that is growing rapidly. And Florida is right behind California in terms of growing the grocery industry. Florida was number two in terms of new grocery stores opened last year to California. So it's a big market, and Publix trying to hold on to their market share by trying something a little bit different for them. I'd like to see how it turns out and whether or not they can leverage their Publix brand identity into that Greenwise Market, and whether or not customers recognize Greenwise as a store private label. If they do, could be very positive things for Publix and perhaps negative things for those competitors like Sprouts.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I pick out a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week or month, and we begin with Leighton.
Warren Buffett, as Trenton had alluded to, is going to be a topic for this week's Looking Ahead. My Looking Ahead has to do with his most recent investment and his most recent investment move in Seritage Growth Properties, which everybody is aware of was spun off in 2015 as the primary REIT from Sears. So Sears ended up spinning off a lot of their real estate and doing leasebacks for a lot of their current properties. Warren Buffett is going to be, through his company, spending $1.6 billion on a loan and another $400 million on a loan option for Seritage Growth Properties. And this is interesting because at one time, Sears held the majority of the leases, but because Sears had been closing around the country, Sears has exited from a number of these spaces, and now Sears only accounts for around 35% of the leases that Seritage has. So Seritage, in response, has been having to redevelop and refashion a lot of these properties to get either new or differentiated tenants. And so you look at that tenant base, Trent, it's a bit more diversified, but changing those properties around, being able to advertise the changes to brokers and area tenants, it's expensive. It takes a lot of money. It's capital intensive. They have 249 properties now. Buffett may not want to see Seritage struggle. If you dig a little bit deeper, you come to find out, and this is why this is my looking ahead, he has a 5.7% stake, give or take, in Seritage Growth Properties. He was actually one of the initial shareholders for the company when it was spun off in 2015. So the loan terms are actually probably pretty favorable for Berkshire, but they don't necessarily want to see Seritage Growth Properties die either. So this is kind of interesting because they want to see them succeed, but they also are going to be extracting around 7% interest for the next few years and 1%, whether or not they take that $400 million option, they're paying 1% on that $400 million option. In the meantime, Seritage Growth Properties is paying a lot in interest. This actually boosts their interest from around $61 million a year to an interest expense of around $116 million a year. So this is interesting and has a lot of analysts scratching their head. However, the positive here is that if Seritage Management has the right strategy in place, they can fill these segments and really argue against the idea that the U.S. economy is over-retailed. And the promising thing is, after all, these funds are intended to be used for what they call further transformation. So obviously, construction companies are going to be benefiting from this, but also those area economies that have seen desolate shopping centers left by Sears, Kmarts, all around the country, those stand to take a great benefit as well. And then obviously the winner in all of this, despite Seritage woes or potential woes, is going to be Warren Buffett, taking a very high interest rate when he already has a very large stake in the company, which issues around a 2.1% dividend.
Well, as longtime listeners of this podcast know, I am a little bit of a beer geek, and this last Thursday, August 2nd, was National IPA Day in the United States. The reason this is in my looking ahead and not looking back, since IPA Day already happened by the time you're listening to this podcast, is this. IPAs were once a banner style of beer in terms of growth. In fact, in 2015, IPA growth surged 199%, but the IPA category saw its growth slow. In fact, its growth down to 16% in 2017, and that is according to the 2017 Consumer Beer Sales Analysis from Beer Connoisseur. Now, that being the case, it is still the largest in terms of share in the craft beer market. IPAs hold about 30% of the dollar share of craft beer in the United States, which is far and away the most of any particular category. However, in terms of looking ahead, IPAs seem to be waning a little bit in popularity, or at least the growth of their popularity, as other styles of beer, most notably sours and fruit-infused beers, begin to get on the rise. So my question is this, in looking ahead, when we're talking about next year's IPA Day, will we be talking about more growth in the IPA sector, or will we be talking about IPAs in the same way we've talked about Sam Adams or Sierra Nevada or even New Belgium's Fat Tire, all three of which lost sales by several million dollars last year over 2016. So what's the story going ahead for IPAs? Are they going to command more shelf space in grocery stores and more consumer attention, or less going ahead? Now, if the answer is less, the key for retailers will be to react to that. Because beer is so perishable, you don't want that loss in terms of product. You want to rotate everything out. And the bottom line is, if you're a retailer, you've got a lot to choose from in terms of the beer selection in your store. So can retailers make that shift quick enough, or will some be left in the dust, or to make an IPA pun, space dust? Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Remember, check us out online at Retail Podcast, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll be back 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.